sounds good. Her voice is so great. Right here on Radio Valencia. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the program. My name is John Hell. This right here is Hell's Kitchen Radio every single Monday night. Radio Valencia. Big thanks to Black On, Black On, Black. They will be back next week every single Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. I'm really excited for tonight. This could be a fun night, man. I'm excited for this. I'm going to wait. I'm not going to have them on yet, but I'll do the intro. I have a good intro that I spent some time with. And anyway, I've got a great guest in the studio, and we're going to bring him on in about 10 minutes. Scott Amendola is his name, legendary Bay Area drummer, and he's played for so many great people. Do the formal introduction in just a little bit. We're here till 10 o'clock. He's brought some of his own music that he's played with, and I also asked him to maybe guest DJ a little bit with me and bring some stuff that he likes, and he said, we got to start with this one, and what I like is, he's, hey, what do you think of Jeff Buckley? And I said, I cried at the documentary. And so did he. Well, how can't you? Jeff was a legend. So we're going to start off, and thanks for bringing this. Recorded live at Glastonbury Festival, June 24th, 1995. This is the song that he wrote in memory about his father and his relationship with his father. Dream Brother, right here on Radio Valencia. Thank you. It's so good. Right here on Radio Valencia, some live Jeff Buckley from Glastonbury, 1995. He died later that year.
He did.
How sad. John Hell is my name, Hell's Kitchen Radio right here in San Francisco. Thanks so much for tuning in. Okay, very excited, so I'm going to do the intro now. Very excited to have in the studio with me drummer, composer, Bay Area legend, behind or on the throne, you got to accept this, Scott Amendola. Now listen, for Scott, I did some research here. The drum kit isn't so much as an instrument as a musical portal. I also stole some stuff from the site. As an ambitious composer, savvy band leader, and capaciously creative foil for some of the world's most inventive musicians, Amendola applies his wide-ranging rhythmic virtuosity to a vast array of settings. Originally from New Jersey, that's awesome. Scott studied at the Berklee School of Music, not here, folks, but in Boston. He then made his way west and made his name known as part of the incredible TJ Kirk, heck yeah, featuring himself alongside Charlie Hunter, Will Bernard, and John Schott. Their second album, If Four Was One, received a Grammy nomination. He's worked with some of the most exciting names in jazz and beyond, including Leary Oakes and Rova Saxophone Quartet, Mike Patton, John Zorn, I Have Questions, Will Blades, Jim Campolongo, Ben Goldberg, Skerrick, Ciro Baptista, and the great violinist Jenny Scheinman, while also leading his own adventurous projects. I'm very excited to welcome Scott to the show. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, man.
Was that okay? Okay.
Also, you know, also cook dinner and like clean the house, feeds the dog.
Do you?
Yeah.
Do you walk the dog?
I feed the dog.
Do you do the laundry?
I do.
Do you do the
dishes? I fold the laundry, which is what keeps the marriage.
I think you're right about that. Do you do the dishes?
Yes.
You're amazing.
I am.
And the brightest smile in all of jazz music. I'm excited for you to be here, so let's start at the beginning. Do you remember the moment you first realized drums were your instrument?
I mean, I was very young, banging on stuff. Like, literally, from before I could remember, I was told, grabbed pots and pans, chopsticks, and just would be banging on stuff. And I was drawn to the drums. It was just a natural thing.
What was your family's, like, reaction to young Scott banging on the pots and pans.
Well, I don't think my parents liked it too much, but my grandfather was a guitar player in New York City, and he was into it. And he was great because we played together a lot when I was a teenager and really kind of started figuring things out.
You know, a lot of people say, you know, musicians, that drums are a great first instrument because it's teaching your rhythm. And so what are your thoughts about that?
Well, what's interesting is that I wanted to take drum lessons right away. Yeah. And my grandfather, being this musician in New York, and he said, you got to take 2 years of piano.
Oh, yeah.
So I took 2 years of piano with this friend of his who was a great piano teacher who was great, but I hated it. I would, like, sit and practice, and I'd go run downstairs and bang on the drums, you know, whatever. And I didn't have a drum set until I was 13. Yeah. So I had just, like, a snare drum and just would make whatever I could to just hit, you know. But, I mean, I think, whatever, if you're drawn to an instrument, you should pursue it. But I play, like, a little guitar, electric bass, and I play piano and stuff. But, it's, you know, drums is what I want to play. And it's just what I always wanted to play.
And you've recorded guitar, have you not?
On a film score, some film score stuff, I've recorded guitar and bass and some other things, including singing.
you say that hesitatingly.
Yeah, what? Because, I mean, you know, it's... So I worked on these film scores with Stephen Drozd from the Flaming Lips and Steve Berlin and one with Adam Dorn. And when I was first doing it with Stephen and Steve, I'd send some, like, ideas. And then Stephen Drozd was kind of, like, doing all the mixing and stuff. And then I'd be like, did you replace it? And he's like, no, I just kept your bass part. And I'd be like, really? Like, you could play it better than me. He's like, no, it's fine. You know, okay. So I was kind of like, all right, whatever, you know.
You like the final mix?
Oh, yeah. Stephen is a genius.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Steve Berlin?
And Stephen Drozd.
Oh, yeah.
Stephen Drozd. They're both geniuses, but Stephen took all our stuff and made this. You can buy this record called The Ten Commandments, this score. And, yeah.
Thank you. Who are some of your early musical influences?
I mean, I listened to a lot of rock music. I listened to a lot of metal when I was really young. But I also listened to jazz. I was very into Pat Metheny, and which led me to, I mean, you know, when you start listening to jazz, and I had people older than me that were musicians, they'd play me Miles Davis and John Coltrane. They'd play me whatever was happening during the day. Like, there are these Steve Kahn records from the 80s with Steve Jordan playing drums. And I still love those records. And hearing Steve Jordan, like, on those records was kind of a big thing. And Weather Report. I mean, early Weather Report. And then, honestly, like, I'd play with my grandfather a lot.
Yeah.
And he was this incredible guitar player, and we would just play jazz. And that was, we'd have these Sunday dinners often at their house, my grandparents' house. And at some point, he'd pull out the guitar and play for, like, 2 hours.
Wow.
And then as I got older and I kind of really understood what he, like, how good of a guitar player he was, and then we started playing together, I really made a point to spend a lot of time with him.
Would you gig with him?
Only once at a weird New Year's gig when he was living at this apartment in Fort Lee, New Jersey, which was but at that point he wasn't really gigging that much.
Okay. But obviously a major influence.
Major. He would take me to jam sessions, and he would just tell me lots of stories, and just was very encouraging.
Yeah. So you moved out to the Bay Area in 92. What were you doing performance wise back in on the East Coast, especially with Berkeley and New York?
I mean, at Berkeley, I was just playing gigs all over town, doing a lot of, like, weddings, and I was in, like, a sort of a world beat band in the 80s, you know, in the early 90s, and then doing funk gigs and doing some jazz, all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
When I was at Berkeley, playing a lot of recitals and doing a lot of recording sessions. And then when I left and I moved back to New York, before I moved here, I was playing in, like, an African band. I was playing jazz gigs. I was doing some sessions. And a lot of it was associated with people that I knew from Boston that had moved to New York, too. And then I went to Europe to play with my roommate, who was an alto player and a bass player.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine that sounds like a very natural path. I'm playing with these people in school. I'm knowing these people. So the first gigs, easily, we're going to be doing together.
Yeah. And people are subbing for gigs, you know.
Right, and that's what I wanted to get to. So what was your experience back on the East Coast when you started subbing, maybe with some larger names, bigger gigs? What was that experience like for you, a young Scott Amendola?
I mean, it was kind of just playing. Like, it was figuring things out, you know. I kind of had a path. But it was really evolving because I you know, when I went to school, I wanted to be Steve Gadd. I wanted to be a session drummer. By the time I left, I was really changed. I wanted to be more like, I was more into like Jack DeJohnette, and I wanted to be more of like a player and an improviser. And you know, I heard Pat Metheny's Song X Band when I was in high school, and that sort of started making sense when I started doing a lot of improvising at school and met people like Jeff Parker, who I've known since like the late 80s.
So did Berklee really push you in the direction that you're in now, or was there ever a thought, maybe I'll do rock or funk or the international sound? What took you in the direction that you're in today towards jazz?
It was the musicians, that the other students at Berklee, you know, like getting exposed. Well, I had this interesting experience because when I was 20, I went home between some. I was living in Boston full time, and I'd go to school in the summer. So after my second year, I was home for a couple weeks, and I went to the Blue Note to hear this piano player, Michelle Camilo, and I got to friendly with the bass player, and the bass player told me that the drummer was leaving. And I used to go see Michelle play at Mikkel's in New York all the time with Dave Weckl and with Joel Rosenblatt and Anthony Jackson and all these people. And I was kind of really into that music. So I went the next night. I had this cassette with me, which had recordings which were very similar to what Michelle was doing with a trio I had in Boston. So the bass player took it, and the next day he called me and said, hey, I'm going to give this to Michelle, because he was auditioning people. So Michelle called me like a couple days later, and then I had like a week and a half to prepare for this audition. And as I'm in my basement listening to this music, I realized like I don't want to play like this. Like it was just this moment of like just realizing kind of where I was at musically, and how I was shifting from what I was listening to, how I was feeling about the drums. So I, instead of like learning the music like the drummer is like, you know, you're young and you're just like, oh, I have to play it this way. Yeah. I just learned the tunes, and I just started making up parts and stuff. And I went in and had a good time, and I didn't get the gig, but I had a blast.
Yeah.
And I left being like, all right, kind of, I'm on a path. I want to find out what it is, what my voice is in music. I wasn't sure who I was, because it was always about like trying to be something else. And then as I got to Boston then, and I started connecting more with musicians, I just sort of was thinking about that, and that was really where I was headed. I was listening to a lot of African music. You know, I listened to someone turned me on to the Meters and Zigaboo, who to me changed drumming.
Yeah.
Just as Tony Allen changed drumming.
Of course.
You know, and Roy Haynes, you know, it's like, and Elvin Jones, you know, and as I started thinking that way, I just started, I practiced a lot. I practiced like 12 hours a day.
Yeah.
And then I would listen to music, hang out with friends, and I was just trying to figure it out, you know.
If you're just tuning in, I've got Bay Area drummer Scott Amendola in the studio with me tonight, Radio Valencia, with me, John Hell, Hell's Kitchen. We're going to take a break. You want to introduce what we're hearing?
Sure. We're going to listen to Jerry Allen, this record called Twilight, which came out in 89. And I don't know if it was one of her early records. It's maybe the first record on Verve she did.
Okay.
But it's a pretty cool record.
Great label.
Yeah.
For sure. What's the track?
It's called When Cubia Dances.
I know. Right here on Radio Valencia.
Thank you.
Jerry Allen right here on Radio Valencia. We think that's from her first Verve release. Is that correct, Scott?
I think that's what we think.
Jerry Allen Trio.
And there's a way to figure that out, but, you know.
It has to be. It's called the Internet. We have it. We just didn't bother looking. John Hell is my name. Hell's Kitchen Radio, Monday nights, 8 to 10 p.m. here in the Mission District at RadioValencia.fm. In the studio, drummer Scott Amendola. We're talking about his career plan. We're going to play his music, too, not just stuff that he likes. We have things. Don't worry about it. Okay, so you played with a lot of different people with a crazy range of sounds. Charlie Hunter, that's where I first became familiar with you, was your time with Charlie Hunter, but sure. Bill Frisell, Jenny Scheinman, Trevor Dunn, Mike Patton, Nels Klein. Nels and you've done quite a few things together. How do you approach collaboration? I can imagine one thing where you're saying, hey, I really like to play with you. I think we can do it. And other times maybe people are approaching you. How do you approach collaboration across such different musical worlds?
I mean, it depends. You know, like the Nels Klein Singers started because Nels and I were playing together in this band, El Stinkbug, which first was called Stinkbug, but there's another band called Stinkbug. We had to call it El Stinkbug.
Oh, very good.
Anyway, and I was on this tour that I was not enjoying, and I emailed him, and I was like, I want to be in a band with you. And he wrote me back saying, funny thing, I want to be in a band with you. So I got home, we got on the phone, and we talked about it. And I also should say that I set up playing his music, and that was his idea. So we talked for quite a while over the course of like a few weeks, and then we found the bass player, and then we got together to play, but we kind of knew it would work, and it just did. If I look up to them, you know, it's like I just want to be there and be ready for anything. And Nels has always been a gracious and amazing band leader and just, you know, kind of mentor in a lot of ways. And he's a dear friend. But, you know, it depends. Like if someone out of the blue writes me, which happens, and then they send me something, I just have to sort of figure out if it's something that I feel like I can be myself on.
Yeah.
And if that's what they want. And a really good friend of mine who I, you know, actually was talking to recently about this, like, said that. He's like, yeah, you know, if something, that's it. It's like, can I be me in this? And if that's what they want, it's great. And, you know, at the same time, there's what, like, working with someone like Pat Metheny, which was incredible to work with, the most articulate musician I've ever worked with. And he has particular things that he wants, but I'm there because he called me. So obviously, like, there's something that I bring to the table that he's interested in, and then he's like, okay, but I want to do this and this and this, and it's like, okay, then let me figure out how to get there, and, you know, and it was incredible.
Well, you have a body of work. So it seems to me if someone's reaching out to you at this point, they are probably familiar with your range.
Probably, yeah.
Right? And I like your thought of, can you be you?
Yeah.
You know, can you bring who you are to it?
Yeah.
And obviously with music, that there's a lot of give and take. It's a dance, right? So you want to feel out your partners as you're playing, but I am bringing me.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I work with Chris Williamson. I don't know if you know who she is. This folk singer, legendary folk singer. And her music is very delicate, and she's an incredible songwriter and lyricist. And it's, you know, people would say it's very simple, but it is simple, you know, in terms of not playing a lot of notes, but it's complex in terms of having it work with what she's doing. But what she's doing is so deep and powerful, I don't need to play a lot of notes. Like Bruce Coburn, I've worked with Bruce a little bit.
You know,
and like, same thing, like incredible singer-songwriters who, the way that they articulate a lyric and the way that, you know, their voices, it's like, I love playing with singers. And Patton, I mean, being on stage with Patton is like, not like, you know, nothing you could possibly imagine.
When you've played with him, I was thinking Trevor Dunn as well, but when you've played with Patton, is there an expectation, because he improvises so much with his vocals, is there, and his vocal manipulation is what I mean. Is there an expectation, you better do this damn same thing, Scott. If I'm improvising my sound, I need you to play with me here. Is that part
of it? Well, it's kind of about playing on that level. So the first couple times that I worked with Mike, one was when I was working with Zorn, and we did Masada in 98 at Slim's, and Mike came and sat in at the end. And then the second time, and we've always been friends and stuff and talked, and then the second time was when we did Cobra, and he was standing next to me, and again, it's Cobra, so, you know, you're not sure what's going to happen, but it's improvising. But most of the stuff I've done with him has been in Mondolkani, which is written, composed music, which is very well arranged, but you know, at any moment, Mike will turn around because he's right in front of me and look at me and say, come on, and give me these sort of signals, which is like, bring it. Like, we're going to take it somewhere, you know? And I've sort of learned what that means and where to go.
You know, Zorn's known for that as well, right?
Oh, yeah.
And he's going to point at you. He's going to tell you what to do. You think maybe, did Patton get that from him?
I think Patton probably got certain aspects of that from him, but I think the thing that a lot of musicians do is that they learn how to, if something's happening, you know, you can communicate on stage.
Yes.
Through eye contact and through hand signals and through whatever, through just music, you know. And with Mike, like, he probably got certain things from Zorn.
Yeah.
But I think he was always interested in these things. And Bungle were our improvisers. And they used to do this thing at the end of their rehearsal where they would just improvise until they all played the same note.
Oh.
And then the rehearsal would be over.
Oh.
You know, they had these little games that they would play.
Wow.
So they were always interested in that. And it's, you know, Mike's a great band leader. And he does not ever phone it in.
Yeah, that's, you know, very obvious.
It's some heavy stuff.
Speaking of, you know, communication on stage, I've seen you so many times, and you always have this just crazy huge smile, and you laugh a lot, and I can tell you're having a lot of fun. But I also see how the other players are doing the same. It's like there's a language that you guys, there's a wink, there's a nod, there's a thing, there's a note or a little rim shot, something where it's almost like these inside jokes that you're throwing in. Can you talk a bit about that communication on stage with your fellow musicians?
Yeah, I mean, it depends who it is. With Charlie Hunter, there's a real deep, like, brotherhood. Like, you know, we joke all the time, and we're just so deeply connected that, you know, a little thing could lead to something, you know, and we're laughing half the time, you know, and having a great time. You know, with Nels, it's a different kind of thing, because Nels is going to give certain cues and certain looks. But we often play with our eyes closed, you know, and but there'll be like a musical thing that'll happen, you know. I mean, it really depends. Like, for me as a band leader, you know, what I'm trying to do is set up a situation where musicians feel comfortable to almost be leaders, you know. And I want there to be eye contact. I want there to be freedom of people to like, I want to be myself. I want them to be themselves. So so when I'm playing with certain people, you know, there's certain cues. Like, Patton does have certain cues for things if things are getting, you know, like, say things are getting, like, he wants to slow down a tempo or speed up a tempo or play a little quieter or something, you know, whatever. It's like there's that, but it really depends on the band leader. And then, you know, as improvisers, which is what I do a lot of, there's just making stuff up on the spot and making, just giving a certain cue that you hope leads to something but might lead to something else, and then you just go with it.
Can you talk a bit about your playing with Blades, with Will Blades? Because I could see you and Charlie, just the two of you, and then you and Blades on the Hammond B3 and everything else, and you're doing some electronics, I think, on some of that too. Talk about the music that you two have composed over the years.
This last record we did, we got together at his place when he doesn't live here anymore, but when he was living in the Bay, and we was just jam. And I would bring some ideas, and so I would bring some full songs, and then I'd go in and just start a groove, and then he would start playing, and then we'd kind of like record it and go home and send it, and then he would sort of work on this and I'd work on that. And so that record was made that way. But before we made that record, we played for a long time, and we played just a lot of each other's music. But again, as improvisers, we would just start different tempos with drums and, say, organ. Like, he's harmonically free, so he can do whatever he wants, so he can change the form of anything, and I'm just about listening. And when I'm playing with people, I'm just about listening, because anything can happen. And when you're playing with someone, like in duo with Will or Charlie, it doesn't matter, like, whatever they're feeling, wherever they want to go. And then when you're playing in a larger group with people, I have this new band called Floating Parade, and the whole concept is improvising on grooves, no written material at all. And we got together a couple times this summer to play, in the spring and summer, to play just to see how it would work, and it was great. And we played a little gig in a Little Hill Lounge in
El Cerrito. Oh, yeah. El Cerrito?
Yeah. And it was...
Oh, really?
And it was super
you're
fun.
Right down the street.
I know,
me?
Man.
Come on, man.
I know. No, but we're going to play the Ivy in October.
Oh, good, good, good.
But that band is just about improvising, and it is about groove. Yeah. So there's this one idea, but, you know, the way that Nate Brenner is playing bass and Mark Clifford and Ryan Schaefer and on the gig was Carl Evangelista, harmonically, they're just so in tune with each other that... they're just going places, you know.
If you're just joining us, I have drummer Scott Amendola in the studio. I'm going to play some Amendola versus Blades.
All right.
This is recorded live at the SJC San Jose. Is that it? The break room. Recorded live January 31st, 2025. Will is on Hammond B3, Fender Rhodes, and the clavinet. You are on drums, percussion, and electronics. And Walltown.
Walltown.
Can I do that?
You can.
We're going to do Walltown.
Sound song for Skerrick.
Right on. Oh, okay. Very good. Radio Valencia.
Who's not there?
We'll be right back.
Who's DJing on that? Radio Valencia.
So funny.
Stickler Phonics with Scott Amendola on drums. Well Blazed, the name of the track right there, and started off that set with Amendola versus Blades.
Yep.
With Walltown recorded live at the San Jose Jazz Break Room, January 31st, 2025. Good evening. Welcome to the program. My name is John Hell. This is Hell's Kitchen Radio every Monday night, 8 to 10, here in San Francisco. In the studio, drummer Scott Amendola.
Hey.
It's all you, buddy. All right. Stickler Phonics is playing this Thursday. Tell us about
This Thursday, September 11th, at the Back Room. And it'll be Danny Lubenladen on trombone, Dan White from Hunter Tones on tenor saxophone, and Ben Goldberg on clarinet. Like a new config.
Oh, Stickler Phonics. And this one, when did you put this out? Not last year.
Yeah.
Was it last year?
2024.
Technicolor Ghost Parade.
Yes.
The name of it, but different players on this. You,
well, Danny's on.
Danny.
And Rafi Garabedian, yeah.
On the tenor.
Yeah.
And you're adding Ben Goldberg on clarinet?
Ben.
Oh, he's great.
Ben, I've known Ben and I were talking about this recently. We've been playing together since 92 when I moved
here.
That's when I met him. He was one of the first people I met.
Is he still doing Gaucho? Is that ever happening?
I don't think that band
probably
is happening.
I don't think so. Somebody died.
Rob, sadly.
Rob. Oh, okay, anyway.
Yeah.
Sorry, Rob. We love you. Yeah. Back to the other stuff. That was a really... Okay, so first off, were you doing electronics on that track, too?
Yeah.
Okay, talk about your foray into the electronics medium.
So, years ago, I've always been interested in electronics. You know, in the 80s, I had a sampler and a drum cat, and it was cool, but it wasn't what I wanted to really do. I always wanted to manipulate the drums. And I didn't figure that out until I moved here and I was working with Mia Masaoka, a Coda player. I don't know if you know her.
Mm-mm.
And I'd heard, obviously, guitar players and guitar pedals and looping and stuff. But Mia had some weird pedals on her Coda. And I was like, man, I want to do that in drums. And she's like, I don't know if you want to do this on drums because it's going to cost you a lot of money and it's going to be really frustrating. And she was right. It did.
Wow.
Do both those things. But I was doing it in my basement. I had this whole setup, and Nels Klein was over my house, and I was like, and somehow we were talking about it. I was like, I want to show you this thing. And I showed it to him, and he's like, dude, you got to bring this on the gig. And I was like, really? And he's like, yeah. So I started bringing it on the gig with the singers, and it was a lot of money and a lot of frustrating times, but slowly evolved into me being able to manipulate the sound of what I do with loopers and delays and reverbs and bit crushers and distortion pedals. And I was doing it exclusively with the singers and this other band called Crater. And then I started bringing it to my own band. And then it also evolved into a place where it got easier and better and smaller. And I just started bringing it, The really a big moment for me was I was playing the Vancouver Jazz Festival with piano player Paul Plimley and Mark Helias, bass player from New York. And I'm setting up, I had this it was pretty small, the board. Not too big, let's say. And I'm sitting there setting up, and Mark walks in, and he looks down at me, he looks at the pedal board, and he goes, what's that? And I'm like, oh, it's just something I'll do. You know, I might not use it, whatever. I mean, it's, like a little, but he's like, I could tell he was like, oh, shit, this is going to be like... after the gig's over, he's like, man, that was really, really cool. And it was sort of, for me, the moment when I was like, okay, I can do this with anybody because it works. I knew it worked, but it just, you want it to be musical. And he and I talked about it afterwards, and he thought it was really musical how I used it.
Did you ever bring it and never use it?
Yeah, I've brought it and used it very little.
Yeah.
I was bringing a bigger setup with Amendola versus Blades because I use it with us, and then I realized I was using it a lot, so I make this little setup that I know I'm going to use just a little bit.
Okay.
But I'm doing this tour with Trevor and Philip, and I'll bring a little bit more because I've been doing this thing lately where I put a mic on Philip, and I'll do some sampling with him, and I do it with Ben also. I did it on this record with Ben and Todd Sikafoos. So I've been doing some of that. I have a trio with Casey Knudsen and Matt Muntz, and I've been doing a little bit on Casey where I just we'll do some little sampling or just weird effects on her. And
do you produce?
I've done a little producing. I produce my own records,
right?
But I've done a little bit of producing of other people's.
How do you like that?
Well,
what do you like about it when you do it?
I like collaborating with people,
yeah.
And I like the idea of helping people figure out their music. Uh-huh. And in general, like, I was just did some a gig with Jenny Scheinman, and Jenny has all this new music, and I've known Jenny forever. We've been playing together forever, so we're rehearsing, and then like she's totally open to ideas. So I was just sort of make suggestions, and I love doing that. Mm-hmm. And I love when people do that with my music, mm-hmm. you know, and they're just like, oh, this could be kind of cool here or there or whatever. You know, it shows that you're really into what's happening and you're super present, and you know, it's like, why not take ideas from people you admire and look up to, and you know, it makes it more interesting.
Do you enjoy engineering?
Not particularly. Yeah. I'm a very basic engineer. Yeah. It took me forever to get into home recording because I'm not an engineer. But a friend of mine who's a really good engineer, a couple friends of mine, but one friend who knew I have this little studio at my house. He's been to my house and he's, heard my room, and he gave me some very basic suggestions of what to do, and it's become very easy. I mean, the truth is, like, I don't know, I could make a very controversial statement about how I think most records don't sound very good.
Oh, and you wouldn't be wrong.
You know, and the thing is that it's like, there's two ways to look at it. Every record has its own sound, and there's great engineers, but it's the music and the musicians that make it. And then you have, you know, the evolution of multi-track recording where it's, you know, a sound, you know, a palette, a paint palette, mm-hmm. you know, and it's that changed everything. So it kind of depends on how you look at it and what you're going for, because everybody's going to criticize every record.
Right.
But when I listen to, like, I make a lot of, you know, jazz records, like live playing records, and it's the playing that matters. Right. You know, the connection, the deep musical stuff that's happening that matters.
And I'm actually thinking about that, about live jazz recordings. You know, how do you prepare for a live jazz recording?